Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. Before chain restaurants and highways, the U.S. had actual regional foods. It's hard to believe, but it's true. And pies, pies, and more pies. I can't stop talking about them. I'll give you the secret ingredient for the best crust. Plus, move over Julie and Julia. One blogger's cooking all the parts of the animal, from nose to tail. I'll tell you why. But first, let's see what's fresh at the farmers markets this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting with Benny Bohm, who is the general manager of Ammo Restaurant. And Benny is here shopping for the restaurant, working with Chef Amy Sweeney. And they're here at the Wednesday Market every single week shopping. And Benny, as always, we'd like to catch up with you and find out what you're cooking. And can you share a recipe with us?
Yeah, lately we've been making a salad of green and yellow zucchini. It's just delicious because they're so good right now. It's a light dish. It doesn't involve a lot of oil or anything. And you just basically take a nice green or yellow or both color zucchini, and you slice them as thin as you can in little ribbons the long way on a mandolin, if possible, without cutting yourself, just a feed in itself. And you toss it with leaves of parsley, and then we use Castelvetrano olives, which are green, big, plump, not too briny olives, a little lemon juice and olive oil, salt and pepper, and you can add mint if you like, too, and just... toss that and then serve it. It's delicious.
Now, those green olives, what kind of olive is that you recommend for this?
We use an Italian varietal called Castelvetrano, and we get them from Guidi Macello here in Santa Monica.
And what kind is it?
It's a green, fresh? It's a really plump, fresh-tasting green olive. Olive that's more reminiscent of olive oil than, say, a Kalamata olive that's really briny and salty.
Okay. So it's absolutely necessary to get one of those mandolins to slice these zucchini. I can't think of another way to make ribbons.
You can use a peeler if you like, and try that.
Ribbons.
Yeah,
okay.
Flat ribbons.
Mm-hmm. And it's just tossed, served at room temperature.
Yes.
And green and yellow zucchini, the flavors are not that different from each other, are they?
No, they're not. It's more an just so pretty.
Sounds really good. Now tell us about the dinner that you're having over there at Ammo that's going to feature one of our farmers.
Yes, we've been, this is the second in our series of farm-to-table dinners. We're working with Windrose Farm, Bill and Barbara, and we're going to use exclusively their vegetables for that dinner. And wine pairing with Tablas Creek Winery. And it's on August 30th, Sunday.
We'll have all that information up on the website for that.
Thank you, Laura.
Daisy Tamai is at the market, both on Saturday and on Wednesday, and in other markets around town. Now, she wears two hats. She works for her own family, Tamai Farm, and then she helps out Phil Green with his Life's a Choke farm stand. Of course, Phil was famous for his virtually year-round asparagus. But Daisy is a great cook in her own right, and we always are lurking around trying to find out if Daisy's cooked anything for the day. And Daisy, you've got a wonderful recipe where you use Gloria's delicious green beans, and you've also adapted it for Phil's artichoke hearts.
Yeah. It's a very simple recipe. Basically, is what I use as a base is the zesty Italian dressing. I add balsamic vinegar and a white vinegar to it and some sugar just to counter the sweetness, tartness. And I marinate both the green beans and the baby artichokes that way. With the green beans, I blanch them, and then I julienne strip red bell peppers, yellow peppers, and orange peppers, along with some red onion. Let those marinate and soak, and they're delicious. You have half an hour, you have a delicious, side dish right there.
Key is blanching. Do you blanch the peppers and onion? You blanch everything or just the beans?
It's just the green beans. You put in the raw peppers and onions.
Okay, and with the artichoke hearts, would you blanch those?
You need to cook those there, depending on the size. You want to prep those, and then put the larger ones in first as you're preparing to blanch, and then the smaller ones, and pull those right out, right into ice-cold water, and drain those well. And the same thing, you use the balsamic vinegar, zesty dressing, sugar, and white vinegar.
Now, do you marinate them to cover? Do you have to, literally submerge
on
them?
The artichokes, yes. The the green beans you can toss, but the artichokes, you want them completely submerged. And the longer, the better that those marinate. And keep them in your fridge. They're so good. You can just snack on them, or you can pull them out and throw them on top of your salad. You have your salad dressing with the artichokes right there on top. They're delicious.
Now, when you say to taste, I know all you chefs always say that, and those of us who don't, they go, what is that? Because we don't taste like you do. But you start with the zesty Italian dressing, bottle dressing, balsamic vinegar, white vinegar, a little bit of sugar. So you want it kind of a perfect balance between tart and sweet?
You do. And it's, you know, it's going to be personal preference again. Everyone has a little different palate. But you want that sweetness along with the tanginess. And you really just have to experiment with the proportions and... I'm sorry, I don't really measure anything. It was always a pinch of this and a pinch of that.
Well, I've tasted your marinated artichoke hearts, and they are delicious. Thank you. Really enjoyed them. Also fresh at the market that's just coming in are the fall pears. Mike Cerrone from Sea Canyon has some beautiful green Bartlett pears, and there's some early Asian pears also showing up at a few stands. And the Asian pears come in a variety of skin tones. They're either russet or yellow or green. There's a pear-shaped Asian pear called the Yali. So come to the market and start looking for pears. I also want to mention that we're having two wonderful events coming up next week. Wednesday, the 26th, we are launching our water bottle free market. We will be having free dispensed filtered tap water, and we're selling reusable stainless steel 1-pint water bottles with the logo I Love Santa Monica Water on them. Those are going to be available starting next week on an ongoing basis. And also, please plan to come visit the next library panel at the Santa Monica Main Library. It's going to take place Thursday, the 27th, from 7 till 9 p.m. The topic this time is Farming for the Next Generation, moderated by Russ Parsons, food by Sasan Rustamian from Sauce on Hampton. Admission is free, and come hear a great panel talking about the future of California farms. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
See what Laura Avery just talked about on her weekly Good Food blog post. You can find it at kcrw.com/goodfood. Thanks to the more than 500 of you who subscribed more than $50,000 during the Good Food Pledge Drive shows over the past 2 weeks. We couldn't do it without you. I can't tell you how gratifying it is to experience your support of both KCRW and this show, Good Food. And if you know anything about me, you know that all I think about is pie. It's kind of nuts, really, but when I started this Pie a Day project for the Good Food blog, I don't think I realized how much dreams of pie would overtake my life. So I ended up talking to other people about it whenever possible. I found another pie fan, and I'll talk with her next when Good Food returns. I knew that I loved pie, but it wasn't until I started making one a day and blogging about it that I understood how many other people really love it just as much as I do. And that includes Rachel Sheridan, the buyer for Cube Marketplace on La Brea.
I made pie when I was little. My mom taught me when I was about 5 or 6 to make pie and to not how not to wad up the dough and melt it all over the place and how to roll it out. We had a really great porcelain table in our kitchen that rolled dough out beautifully. So she taught me really young. And I was always really intimidated about it, I have to say. I mean, because, you know, nobody makes pie like your mom. But now that I'm in California and she's in Ohio and I've kind of had to make myself learn, I love making it. I mean, you can do it in the food processor. It's really easy.
Yeah, and actually, you know, you think to yourself, oh, it's cheating to do it in the food processor. And then you start reading all of these amazing cookbook authors who test like crazy, and they use the food processor.
Totally.
So you think, oh, that's okay.
No, it actually works really easy, and you still have to roll it out. It won't roll it out for you. So you really are still doing the hard part.
So many people come up to me, and they're afraid of crust, which for me is sort of the least scary part of making a pie.
Yeah. No, I'm always afraid of a runny pie. I'm never afraid of the crust.
A runny pie or a pie that doesn't look pretty. I mean, a lot of my pies aren't super pretty. It's really funny, this Pie Day experience where we're getting pictures from all kinds of listeners who are making pies, and their pies are so much more beautiful than my pies.
I know. But you know what? I always feel like the more rustic mine looks, that's just it's going to taste better. I actually had a pie explode once, which was fun.
Did you not vent it?
I did. It was in an old Pyrex, and apparently Pyrex has an expiration date. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
It exploded. It totally exploded. Scaring your listeners.
All of my pans are old Pyrex pans.
Yeah. No, apparently they lose their temper or something like this, and you can explode pie. But it's fun. I mean, I felt very Julia Child befuddled in the kitchen, so it was a learning lesson.
Let's talk about crust for a minute. What is your favorite pie crust?
My favorite one is a leaf lard one, and it's half leaf lard, half butter. So I really like that. And that might be scary for some people, but it's really easy and it's so good. And it's really, some people say, oh, you need a different pie crust for like a savory pie. But I feel like this pie crust is just like an all-arounder and really good.
What is leaf lard?
Leaf lard is, they think it's like the best lard. Everybody says it's the best, and it's from around the kidneys of a pig. So it can be kind of hard to find sometimes. I know that Surface has it all the time, but you do have to render it yourself, which also sounds scary, but basically that just means cutting it into cubes and melting it down and then straining it.
And then you get these little great chicharrones at
the
end.
Totally, yeah, which my boyfriend steals out of the kitchen. No, but it's really good, and you just keep it in a mason jar like you would bacon drippings or anything, and then you just scoop it out when you're ready for it.
And the beautiful thing about leaf lard is now that we're all told that Crisco is sort of poison because the hydrogenated, and now lard is considered the more healthy alternative.
Totally. And it just makes such a better pie.
Oh, it makes it so flaky.
So good.
Do you get a porky flavor in the dough?
No. I think you just get a richness, like something that you just don't get from butter.
Do you keep your leaf lard refrigerated?
I do. Plus, it's good, too, because then it's handy because you need it cold anyway when you're going to stick it in the dough.
We should probably mention about why it's so important for pie ingredients, crust ingredients, to be cold.
Yeah, you don't want everything to melt into a gluey glob and all that gluten to get all. You want flaky.
Flaky. I mean, basically what the butter does is it creates the flakiness because it melts away.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have these shattering layers.
Yeah, it creates the steam,
dough.
Like puff pastry. It's same concept, just like a little poof.
One of the great things about doing these pies a day is that you have the opportunity to make the same thing over and over and over again, and then also tweak it. And I feel like I have these cookbook authors who have become my teachers.
Totally.
And so right now, my two primary teachers are Dori Greenspan and Rose Levy Barenbaum, who's the whacked out crazy scientist at Baker's.
I know. She's so amazing.
She's amazing. If there is any kind of variation, no matter how small, she's found it.
And her blueberry pie, have you made the blueberry pie out of her
pastry?
No, not yet. It's awesome. And it takes like 20 minutes. It's so fast because you just cook a cup of the blueberries with, I think, sugar and lemon and cornstarch. And then you add the rest fresh and it turns this brilliant blue color. And then you just pour all that into your baked crust. And you just, when it's ready, it's ready. When it sets, it's done. It's so easy.
One of my favorite techniques that she's taught me is for making this sort of all-purpose, all-butter crust is usually what I always do is pulse the butter in. And she says, no, take two-thirds of your butter and process it so it's really worked throughout the flour. Then take the last third, throw that in, and pulse that. So you get the butter diffused through the flour in two different ways.
Nice. So you get like the bigger chunks and the little air pocket thing going on.
Do you ever make a vinegar crust?
I do. I actually put, if it's butter, I put apple cider vinegar. If it's lard, I put white wine vinegar.
But I always thought using vinegar or wine, or now some people are using vodka, is instead, what it does is it allows you to use less water and it evaporates away.
Oh, I don't.
So it also helps make a flakier crust.
I got to be honest, I don't think I knew why I was doing it.
This is an America's Test Kitchen tip that I learned from Jack Bishop.
That's a great tip.
Yeah.
So how much vodka do you add?
Well, let's say you're going to add 3/4 of a cup of water to your crust.
Okay.
They'll add 1/2 cup of water and 1/4 cup of vodka.
How do they figure that out?
I don't know. Their entire life is slavishly making things 100 times. Okay, your final question.
Okay.
What's your favorite pie?
Sour cherry. I love sour cherry pie. We had a tree in my yard when I was growing up, and it's like, tastes like home. But no almond extract. I think that's a sin against man. Don't do that.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks so much, Evan.
Rachel Sheridan's the buyer for Cube Marketplace on La Brea. I've got a picture of a peach pie that I made with leaf lard. It's part of my Pie a Day project on the Good Food blog. And you can watch a video with me and Rachel and the champagne grape pie that she brought into the studio. Find it at kcrw.com/goodfood or on the Good Food Video iPhone app. The American South has an intense pie tradition. I spoke to author Molly Cox Bryan about the famous Mrs. Rao, who's known as the Pie Lady in Virginia.
Mrs. Rao was a woman that grew up in the mountains of Virginia, and she ran a restaurant here in Stanton, Virginia, which is now celebrating its 67th year. And she had this incredible life story where her husband left her with three small children in 1942. There was no Social Security or anything like that back then to help her out, or welfare or anything like that. So she started a restaurant. And the restaurant today is one of the most successful family-run restaurants in the state of Virginia.
And the pies in particular, what is she known for? What's her style, if we could say she has a style?
I would say down-home Southern. The pie that I think of first when I think about her is her coconut cream pie.
Do most of the pies stay to sort of tried and true, very traditional recipes? Are there little twists that people have come to think of as purely her?
I think most of the pies are very traditional. Every once in a while, in fact, you know, they have certain pies that are there all the time, like the coconut cream and the chocolate and the peanut butter. But they're very traditional, and so much so that a lot of longtime customers plan, you know, their events, their family events, around when Mrs. Riles is going to have strawberry rhubarb pie or mincemeat pie. So they know exactly, you know, when those pies are going to be available, and that it's been consistent for 67 years.
I'm baking a pie a day until Thanksgiving. Check on my progress on the Good Food blog. You can find all my pies there at kcrw.com/goodfood. I have pie on the brain, but a lot of people have cocktails on the brain. The cocktail renaissance is fierce. The embrace of seasonal produce has had its influence on the cocktail glass, and now mixologists get as much attention as chefs. How bartenders got their mojo back when Good Food returns here on KCRW and KCRW.com. The phrase, let's go get a drink, is much more complicated than ever to implement. With bartenders transforming themselves into mixologists or bar cooks, the possibilities for delicious cocktails are overwhelming. Whether it's the hippest tiny speakeasy or the simple bar at your favorite seasonal menu-based restaurant, there's never been a better time to go sip a beautiful cocktail. Famed New York restaurateur Danny Meyer has a gorgeous new cocktail book. It's called Mix, Shake, Stir. So it seems that over the last couple of years, cocktails have been really making a resurgence. We're seeing all sorts of interesting liquors and inspired preparations. When did you start to really feel this percolating?
I can't put my flag in the sand exactly, but it feels like really the last 4 to 6 years, and I'm pretty sure I know why. I feel like so many really, really good restaurants across the country have focused so much on seasonal ingredients and, you know, totally educating their staffs of, you know, food-loving waiters and cooks alike in why really good food tastes like it tastes. And I think that that's given rise to a whole new generation of bartenders who said, wait a minute, why is everybody in our restaurants only talking about ingredient-driven food menus and, you know, all the wonderful wines we serve? Why can't we do the same things? And I think that as a way to distinguish one's bar, increasingly bartenders, mixologists, restaurateurs have looked to the kitchen and looked to the kinds of ingredients that are used in the kitchen and said, why can't we up the game even when it comes to cocktails?
So in your own experience in your restaurants, was it a particular bartender that came to you and said, here, try this?
I remember the first time that I really started hearing a lot about cocktails within our restaurants was at Gramercy Tavern. I started to hear from bartenders probably about 10 years ago about, you know, how they really wanted to use the blackboard in back of the bar to distinguish the bar there. It is, after all, a tavern. But I think it really got off and running for us when we opened our restaurant Tabla, the Indian restaurant, and we started to think about what kind of cocktails might one serve to go with Indian spices and Indian flavors. And we came up with some really wonderful cocktails at Tabla that used some of the same flavors that that you might find on the menu there. And then we kicked it into even higher gear when we opened the Modern at the Museum of Modern Art, and we started using the restaurant itself, this wonderful art museum, to inspire the kinds of cocktails we would serve. We came up with something there called Cubism. Very, very simple, but it was basically taking a glass of Prosecco and instead of serving the Prosecco in a flute, as you would most sparkling wines, we served it in a Collins up glass with ice cubes made out of freshly squeezed Concord grape juice.
Mm, wonderful. So give us an idea for a summer cocktail.
Well, I think you should always begin with your favorite spirit. It's not that it's one should not experiment with new spirits, but if you happen to love rum, you know, the first thing I think about in terms of a refreshing summer drink is a mojito. But one need not say that a mojito can only be with sugar and you know, muddled mint. And so, for example, if you go to your local market and you say, what's my favorite fruit? There's nothing to keep you from taking that, whether it's apricots or peaches. We've got a great recipe for a watermelon mojito, and realize that basically all a mojito is infusing the rum with some sugar, some additional sugar, and in the case of a classic mojito, some mint. But you could add to that mint in the same way that you would add mint as an accent to a fruit salad. Just figure out what kind of fruit you like. You could do it with fresh strawberries, fresh apricots. So that's the type of thing I think about is especially with your more neutral spirits like white rum and vodka, is using the same kind of produce that you would cook with anyhow and putting that to good use for your cocktails. You can use fresh tomatoes, which is adding acid and a little bit of sweetness. And you don't have to make a classic Bloody Mary where you're using the highly pulpy, highly salty tomato juice that one typically buys in a store. There's every reason that you could just make your own tomato water. Ice cubes, by the way, are a great way to sort of give variety to your cocktails. And the shape of ice cubes, as well as the flavor of your ice cubes, is, I think, one of the most underrated ways to really add a fresh dimension to your cocktails. And it's the type of thing that when you have guests over to your home, people really, really love. It's almost like a kid getting a popsicle stuck in the middle of their cocktail.
Yeah, I've started just taking small Ziploc bags and filling them up with whatever I want, throwing them in the freezer, and then using an ice pick to break it down into cubes.
Can I come over?
Anytime. Thank you so much, Danny.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Evan. Thank you so much for having me.
Danny Meyer owns a number of very successful restaurants in New York City, including Gramercy Tavern and Union Square Cafe. His new book is called Mix, Shake, Stir. Find his recipe for the watermelon mojito on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Today's bartenders sound like they have PhDs in mixing drinks. Here are two of Danny Meyer's mixologists musing about their favorite cocktails. We start with Aaron Ashkenazi on Velvet Falernum.
A liqueur that has a tropical element to it, the brand Velvet Falernum, was said to be created by John D. Taylor in Barbados. It's really a rum-based liqueur infused with sugarcane syrup, which is obviously the base of the distillate for a rum as well, just to sweeten it up. And then the other round flavors that go in there are lime, there's some clove, you get an almondy quality to it as well. But it's a really interesting tropical inflected product. Probably the most popular drink utilizing Velvet Falernum is the Mai Tai, which was said to be created by Trader Vic. And that's really a tropical drink. It consists of both light and dark rum, obviously the Velvet Falernum, and then an interesting syrup called Orzat syrup, which is an almond inflected syrup, and also orange curacao, which is really a proponent of a lot of tropical flavored drinks to kind of sweeten them and also give a citrus character to it. But I'd say the Mai Tai is probably the most popular or most widely known drink that uses that specific product.
My name is Sam Lip. I work as the assistant general manager at 11 Madison Park Restaurants in New York, and am a big lover of chartreuse. Chartreuse is an herbal liqueur made by Cartusian monks in France, and it has been made by these monks for centuries now. It's passed down as an oral tradition, so it's, again, kept very, very secret, and has been much the same and undisturbed for hundreds of years. It's one of the most complex spirits that you find behind a bar. It's incredibly aromatic, and you can pull out lots of different types of aromatics, anything from anise to cinnamon to cardamom to coriander to clove to vanilla and many, many other spices that I can't even put a name to. But it really is just a very herbaceous, very pungent, very floral liqueur. So at 11 Madison Park, we came up with a cocktail called the PC Fizz, which is a take on a classic fizz, which is, in this case, an egg white cocktail, P standing for Pim's Cup, however, and C for chartreuse. We're using yellow chartreuse and Pim's Cup, not necessarily in equal proportions, but blending those with an egg white, a little bit of simple sugar, and lemon and lime juice. Shake that for about 30 seconds. And then serve that without any ice in a highball glass.
I'll have recipes for the Mai Tai and PC Fizz on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. What's your favorite drink? Mine is a gin gimlet. Let me know yours. Leave a comment on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. Select latest show and scroll down to the bottom. Before there was margarita mix and a Denny's in every city, there were true regional cuisines in this country. What life tasted like before national highways, chain restaurants, and frozen food. That's coming up next. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW, and I'm your host, Evan Kleiman. America Eats was a project commissioned by FDR's Works Progress Administration Federal Writers Project. Writers were commissioned to chronicle the food events taking place all over the U.S. The result was an abundance of notes and recipes from county fairs, barbecues, and church socials from all across the country. Contemporary food writers who lean to the historical are rightly fascinated by this really unique window into our past, and no one more so than Mark Kurlansky, author of Food of a Younger Land. So let's talk about what you found when you went to the Library of Congress to take a look at these documents.
The thing that's really interesting about these documents is that they were completely unedited and by and large were not intended for publication. They had the Federal Writers Project had divided the country into five regions and had five writers who were going to write about 100-page essays on their region. And to write those essays, they were going to be informed by all of these reports that people sent in from all over their region. You know, some people sent in lists. Some people sent in recipes. There were short stories. There were poems. These five writers were going to extrapolate from this into these essays. But then December 7th, 1941, Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And Catherine Kellogg, whose idea this project was, on December 8th and 9th, sent out these frantic letters saying, everybody, whatever material you have on America East, just send it in now, and we'll try to do something with it before we're closed down. And she gave them to the Library of Congress, where they have sat ever since.
So give us a portrait of what America's food landscape was like at the time that these little snippets were written.
It was very much like, you know, a lot of the food movements of today, only it wasn't movements. It's just what was there. It was very local, based on local products, which made it very seasonal. And it was very steeped in local traditions, both traditions in terms of recipes and kinds of food, but also in terms of kinds of gatherings, a lot of traditional gatherings. Midwesterners setting up boards on sawhorses out in the field after threshing and having a big feast, and clam bakes in New England. And there's one in there where people in Los Angeles who are from Iowa annually get together for an Iowa meal. And there's one in Vermont, where in around Barre in Vermont, where there were stone quarries. A lot of Italians moved there. And once a year, all the Italians would get together and cook Italian food.
What were some of the most interesting food finds that you saw?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting to see recipes that were about making do during the Depression, people who didn't have much. There's a recipe from Maine for fish or clam chowder where you cook down the salt pork and you add potatoes, and then after that you would add, you know, milk or fish or clams or something. But it says if you don't have any of that, you can just stop right there and call it potato chowder. And it's actually, I've done that. It's a great soup. There's a cake from Montana, I believe, that they call Depression Cake. It tells this nice story about these people. It's the 4th of July, and they have to have a cake, and they don't have any eggs, and they don't have any butter. And they take some flour and some baking soda and some pork fat and a lot of spices and mix it all together. And miraculously, to everybody's surprise, it came out looking just like a cake, and they tried it, and it was pretty good. I tried that one also, and it's a very nice cake.
Now, did any of the recipes or food cultural traditions strike you because they live on strongly today?
A lot of this food, I would say most of this food, is still around today, but the difference is that in 1940, it was the food of America. Today, you have to be a detective to find it.
Give me an example.
Well, you know, persimmon pudding is still made in a couple of counties in southern Indiana. Brunswick stew is still made, although rarely with squirrel, whereas it was commonplace in the 1930s. You know, I've been doing a lot of call-in radio around the country, and I've learned never to say that anything doesn't exist because somebody will call in and tell you they still make it.
Wow. Wow. What about beverages? What about Coca-Cola? Was there anything about Coke in the archives?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. There were a couple of things. There was a little item about Coca-Cola parties, about young women getting together and chilling glasses and sitting around sipping Coke. There was also mention of Coca-Cola, drinking Coca-Cola with ammonia.
With ammonia?
With ammonia. And so somebody came up to me in Atlanta who seemed to be perfectly alive and said that she grew up drinking Coca-Cola and ammonia, said it tasted kind of like vanilla, which is sort of like saying that, you know, the thing you shot and ate in the backyard tasted like chicken. But later in Virginia or Washington, somebody came up to me and said, you know what the deal was with Coca-Cola and ammonia? That's when you were pulling an all-nighter for an exam or something. It was like speed. Anyway, don't try this at home, folks.
Oh, so interesting. It's really a fabulous book, and I'm so happy you did it.
Oh, thank you.
Food of a Younger Land is Mark Kolanski's book. I'm interested in any regional foods from long ago that you might continue to eat. Send me a note or a comment on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. Before we bought our meat wrapped in plastic from giant cold cases, people ate as much of the animal as they could, from the nose to the tail. That's the name of an English cookbook that contains recipes for all parts of the animal. Next, I'll introduce you to a man who's cooking his way through this book, literally from nose to tail. Move over, Julie Julia, meet Ryan Adams. That's in 1 minute here on 89.9 KCRW and kcrw.com. The film Julie and Julia is partly based on blogger Julie Powell's attempt to cook her way through Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking. We found the male version of this culinary adoration in Ryan Adams' blog Nose to Tail at Home. Texan Ryan Adams is cooking his way through British chef Fergus Henderson's The Whole Beast, Nose to Tail Eating. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, how's it going?
I'm just fascinated by your decision to do this. So people can really understand what you've taken on. Could you tell our listeners about Fergus Henderson and his philosophy of nose-to-tail eating?
Mr. Henderson's view on cooking and eating animals boils down to one thing. He stated before that if you kill an animal, it only seems polite to use the whole thing. And so everything's fair game. It doesn't matter what part of the animal we're talking about, the brains, the kidneys, the stomach, the spleen, everything has its place. And he's found a way to use pretty much everything and make it delicious.
Now, before you started this project, had you eaten a lot of what people call offal?
No, I had not, actually. And it was actually Anthony Bourdain's profession of love for Fergus's food that really got me interested and made me decide maybe this is going to be something wonderful.
Do you remember what the very first recipe was that you made out of his book?
Oh, yes. Pumpkin and bacon soup.
Oh, that sounds delicious and not so weird at all.
No, it was actually, it's the first recipe in the book, and I decided, okay, well, this isn't too over the top, and it turned out really well. I was like, okay, if this isn't so bad, let's go on.
And what's the most recent dish you made?
Actually, today, I'm going to be making pheasant and trotter pie with a suet crust.
Oh my gosh! You know, I'm doing this pie a day project that I've been blogging about all summer long. I'm making a pie a day. You have to take a picture of it and send it to us so we
can
post it.
That was the plan. I actually picked it specifically because I was like, well, if I'm going on the show and she's making pies, then I better belly up to the bar and make one as well.
Oh, how great. So this process that you've been going through, aside from just introducing you to a lot of parts of the animal that you had never cooked before, has it expanded your culinary technique in other ways?
Incredibly. Before I started this, I would watch Food Network. I would watch Anthony Bourdain's programs. I would read extensively, but it was more about enjoying what other people were doing rather than trying and learning myself. And I make my own stock now. I've picked up a couple of things from the book. We're making pickles nonstop.
Yeah, I know. You know, in reading that book, one of the things that really struck me was how many pickled accompaniments there are to these kinds of dishes.
Mm-hmm. I need to find pickled walnuts. I think I'm going to just have to order them because there's no recipe in the book. And he says that he craves them so often that sometimes he wonders if he's pregnant. So they must be something fantastic. So I almost want to put out like a bounty. I need to find a woodcock. It is probably one of the toughest ingredients to find, at least for me being here in the middle of Texas. I am just totally unable to find one. I've talked to multiple people in farmers markets. I've talked to people online. Either I need to, A, go hunting in North Carolina, which would be a first, or B, which is probably more likely at this point, head over to UK and go to a market there and find one because it's just escaped me. I've tried every avenue available, and it's just not happening. I've almost considered putting out a bounty on one. So,
we'll post it on our blog, and maybe you can get some information. Have you ever butchered a whole animal at home?
I have not taken apart a whole animal. That's probably beyond my ability at this point. But I've learned a lot about deboning and making use of all of those extra bones, stocks and whatnot.
Now, one of Mr. Henderson's signature dishes is the veal bone marrow and parsley salad, which involves assembly at the table by the diner as a way of including them in the entire experience. Have you tried it at home with guests?
Multiple times.
Really?
And every single time I've ever put down a bunch of bone marrows in front of a guest and said, go to town, you see it in their eye. The second they take that first bite and they start to chew and it just hits them. Wow, I had no idea that this could take us like this.
Find a link to Ryan's blog, Nose to Tail at Home, on our website. If you have any ideas where Ryan can find woodcock or pickled walnuts, leave a comment on today's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. There is nothing like a food odyssey to give you purpose in life, like Greg Ng. He's the frozen food master. He spends a lot of time eating his way through the freezer aisle of the grocery store. Lucky for us, he reviews frozen food products on his website. What possessed you to tackle the frozen food aisle?
The big thing for me was I was bringing frozen foods to lunch every day. And when you go to the freezer aisle, you really have no concept of which is better than the other. And there really wasn't anything on the internet that was out there telling me which one was better. So I really wanted to be that authority.
Have you always been a fan of frozen food? Did you grow up eating a lot of it?
I wouldn't say a lot of it, but, you know, it was always that time between coming home from school, before dinner. I was a growing boy, always found a frozen pizza in the freezer and popped that in between meals. And then when I went to college, of course, that escalated like most college kids.
I've watched several of your videos. They're really fantastic. But what really impressed me was how serious you are. You give so much detail about each item. How many do you do a week? And do you try and divide it up between breakfast, lunch, and dinner items?
I produce 5 reviews a week. I do try to spread evenly. If, say, I do a healthy choice meal on a Monday, you probably won't see another healthy choice meal the rest of the week. It does become seasonal, however. Once it started becoming springtime, I started reviewing hamburgers on the grill. Now that it's summertime, I'm really dialing up the popsicles and the ice creams and the frozen desserts.
I love that it's seasonal frozen food.
Right,
it's sort of an oxymoron.
Right.
Tell us about your throwdowns.
Sure. My throwdowns are frozen food throwdowns. A lot of times you might walk down the aisle and see a Pillsbury frozen pancake next to an Aunt Jemima frozen pancake, relatively the same price, but which one is better? So I really pitch those head to head. I just did an epic 5-episode macaroni and cheese throwdown.
Who won?
I did give it to Stouffer's. However, Boston Market's taste and consistency actually ranked that pretty close to Stouffer's. The reason why I gave the edge to Stouffer's was mainly because Boston Market used a rotini noodle instead of an elbow macaroni. And I felt that they kind of benefited from that, you know, extra surface space on that particular noodle.
I have to say that one of the first reviews I went to was the cat and dog ice cream.
Right. Right. That was a situation where I'm never one to turn down a challenge.
Okay, so tell me now the 3 best things you've tasted so far and the 3 worst things you've tasted.
By far, the best thing I have ever tasted in the 140-some reviews I've done is a breakfast sandwich. It's called the So Lean brand muffin breakfast sandwich. And what I loved about it is I am a sucker for McDonald's sausage McMuffin with egg. However, those have, you know, 26 to 30 grams of fat in it. This tasted almost identical to it with only 5 grams of fat. The other two, also 5-star winners. One was a limited edition pumpkin flavored ice cream by Edie's. Tasted just like what you would imagine frozen pumpkin pie would taste like. And then the final one was a Calypso coconut shrimp from Margaritaville brand. And it was a really nice butterfly cut, large shrimp. And it was just a great tasting hors d'oeuvre.
And the worst, aside from the ice cream, the pet ice creams?
Right. One of the worst was a meal by Banquet. It was called the Banquet Cheesy Smothered Meat Patty Meal. It was smothered in processed cheese. They threw in some bacon bits, or so they said it was bacon bits. They really didn't have the decency or respect to even tell me what type of meat it was. It was truly the most disgusting thing I've tasted. There was also a small little sandwich called the Deli Express Barbecue Deluxe Sandwich, and this was equally bad. And then finally, which was very scandalous, actually, when I reviewed this, was the Morningstar Bacon Strips. I'm a huge fan of Morningstar, and I think they do vegetarian and vegan dishes quite well. But this one in particular, I believe I said that it was like a bacon-flavored bookmark. It was extremely brittle. It was extremely dry. And I did get quite a bit of angry Morningstar lovers out there. The worst rated stuff, I only give a 0.5-star instead of a 0-star. And I think that a lot of that has to do with the same mentality of when you have poor service at a restaurant, when they say it's worse to give a penny as a tip than it is to give nothing. I'm acknowledging that I did try it, that it is horrible, and it wasn't a mistake that I didn't assign it a rating. So I do give a 0.5-star through a 5-star.
I have to ask you about your health. Have
sure.
you have you A, gained a lot of weight, and B, developed hypertension from all the sodium?
In the first month or so, when I was truly kind of discovering the type of process that I was doing, I did gain a few pounds, and I found that I've had to put in an extra amount of time on the treadmill every week to kind of keep that off. In terms of hypertension, fortunately for me, I do not consume the entire meal. So where I'm reviewing a product, for instance, a Hungry Man dinner that might have over 2,000 milligrams of sodium, once that camera stops, I stop as well. Unfortunately, it means a lot of times the food is wasted because I'm not going to push that on my wife either.
Well, Greg, everybody here at Good Food has really enjoyed watching the videos. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Greg Ng is the frozen food master Watch his video reviews of frozen food products on his site. You can find it when you go to kcrw.com/goodfood. I asked about favorite frozen foods on my Facebook page. Trader Joe's seems to be the winner in supplying your favorites, from pizzas to pot pies to gyozas. Next on Good Food, the king of Orange County, Gustavo Arellano, takes us out for a bite. I'm your host, Evan Kleiman, and I'll be right back on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. Southern California is filled with places to go eat delicious ethnic food. We tend to concentrate on places in LA County, and so it's good to take a little peek behind the orange curtain every once in a while. That's why we invite Gustavo Arellano, food editor for the OC Weekly, to the show. Hi, Gustavo.
Hola, Evan.
Where are we going today?
To my beautiful hometown of Anaheim, Wadia cuisine.
Wadia.
So the only Sri Lankan restaurant in Orange County, one of the few Sri Lankan restaurants in Southern California, I'd even say the country.
What are some hallmarks, some dishes that one must not miss eating Sri Lankan food?
Black curry. To me, the epitome of Sri Lankan cuisine is black curry. I'm Mexican. I love spicy food. But only two times in my life have I ever eaten something so spicy that I was coughing and choking for half an hour afterward, and that was with Sri Lankan black curry. One time it was at a restaurant in New York. The other time was here at Wadia.
That's a good thing?
No. That said, it's because I thought, I could just drink it like I do tapatio. But no. In portions, if you mitigate it with white rice, this is a curry that will remind you of mole negro from Oaxaca, with a little bit more spice, with a little bit more bay leaf, and they make it here at Wadia with lamb. So you have the gaminess of the lamb with the sweetness of the black curry and that heat. So order it definitely, but be careful with it because it will sneak up on you. It's not like an habanero where you immediately, or like habanero salsa where you eat it and immediately you're burning. No, this sneaks up on you. So eat about 5 or 6 spoonfuls, then take a half hour break, then go at it again.
What turns the sauce black?
It's a combination of all the peppers that they put in there, a combination of the peppers, some oils, and of course, we're in Sri Lanka, so God knows how many spices they're putting in there. Really, the curries of Sri Lanka, I would argue, are better than the curries of India, just because they do take the care, as like they do in Oaxaca with the mole, just taking care of it for hours. And here they have a lot of curries. They also have a tuna curry that they – it's called I'm sorry for the Sri Lankans that I'm going to mispronounce their word, but it's Ambul Thiyal. It's a tuna curry. It's a little bit of a bitter curry with a sweetness because they make it with a fruit that I've never heard of before until I came here, called goraka.
What is a goraka?
A goraka, I wish I could visualize it, but the taste is somewhere between lemongrass and tamarind. So you're going to have...
Love that.
That refreshing but slightly bitter flavor that will just zing at you from time to time. So they make it here. They sell beef curries, pork curries, all types of curries. And of course, though, if you're going to buy a curry dish, you have to get what Sri Lanka is probably most famous for, the hoppers.
Okay. Now, I'm familiar with string hoppers, which are made by drizzling a dough. It's a rice flour dough,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, rice flour.
Into the water, and it forms this little this flat nest that you use to pick up the curry. They're addicting.
Oh, they're beyond addicting. They're also very distinctive because the string hoppers, you could buy them, and it's not its own dish. It's a side dish that you use to pick up curries and all the other sauces that they have here at Wadia. And they remind me of this Vietnamese dish where it's like it's vermicelli noodles, but they're all made into little patties, and they're just so intricately spliced together, really. But they also have just regular hoppers, and they remind me of the taco shells that you'll see for taco salads at Mexican-American restaurants, that sort of, right side up, almost like a rhombus type of thing. They make it with this rice flour, and they're huge. They're huge. You order 3 food to an order for about $3. Next time I go, I'm just going to pour in my entire meal there to make it like those sourdough bowls that you go at some of our lesser restaurants. I also like, though, their egg hoppers. It's the same rice flour made huge like that taco shell, but they bake egg over easy right into it.
Oh, my God!
You just take a little knife. You let the yolk kind of settle in, and the yolk hardens because the egg hopper is still a little bit hot. And then, again, you just start ripping it up, scooping up the rice, scooping up the curry, scooping up any of the meats that they have there. This is really – when I wrote this review a couple months back, I hadn't been so excited about a restaurant in so long just because – It seems familiar. Sri Lanka is right off the coast of India, but it's a cuisine unto itself, really.
What about the condiments?
Oh, my God, the condiment. Again, I'm Mexican. I say that every 5 minutes. So I love our salsas, but the best condiment on earth is sambal. It's a name for different types of Sri Lankan condiments, but my favorite one there is a coconut sambal. So imagine coconut shavings, dried chilies that they chop up, some onions, some dried fish, anchovies, I think, then some more fish sauce, a couple more chili pods in there. You combine it all together, mix it up, and then you just sprinkle it over whatever food that you buy. Sweet, very spicy again, that wonderful pungency of the dried shrimp. I need to go back there. I'm going to buy cases of it like you usually would with kimchi. I'm surprised that chefs here have not discovered sambal. And that's just one type of sambal. Another type of sambal, it reminds me more of Mexican-style salsa when you have the whole peppers in there. But it's much bitter, much spicier. But you have just full lengths of chili, of Sri Lankan chilies in there. And you also pour that on top of your food. But the coconut sambal, it's masochism inside a bowl, really. Sweet with a hot. Again, you have to do it judiciously. Don't put it all in your mouth like I did and be very sad afterwards.
Thank you so much, Gustavo.
Gracias to you, Evan.
We will have the restaurant and all the information on where it is and how to find it on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. Gustavo Arellano comes to us from the OC Weekly, where he's the food editor. Before I go, I have to share with you this wonderful story. The show is based in Los Angeles and broadcast in Southern California, but through the magic of podcasting, Good Food has found listeners all over the globe, including Shanghai, China. I got a letter from Shanghai listener Jim Rice. He told me what happened after he listened to a Good Food segment on barbecue.
During the summertime, I was listening to Good Food, and the discussion was about summer barbecues. And that's something the Chinese don't normally do. You know, they cook in a wok. And so here in Shanghai, we gathered our neighbors and did an American-style barbecue in my backyard. The Chinese loved it because in Shanghai, you would receive guests at a restaurant. You would always take somebody out at a restaurant. You wouldn't take them home. But the barbecue and this American-style barbecue was very exciting for them, and they realized the kind of the social interaction. And you know, you don't stand around a wok and talk, but you stand around a barbecue and talk. Our Chinese neighbors learned this, and we now rotate so that every weekend somebody else has a barbecue at their house. And it's a little bit of a Chinese flavor and sometimes some American steaks and some hot dogs and Chinese sausages, so it's a good mix.
That was Jim Rice, a Californian who's based in Shanghai, China. You can podcast or download this show. You can find all past episodes and lots of great video at kcrw.com/goodfood. And, of course, you can follow me on Twitter to get instant updates of my Pie a Day project. I'm at Evan Kleiman. That's K-L-E-I-M-A-N. And you can spend some time with your food friends on Facebook. Follow my fan page there. The executive producer of Good Food is Jennifer Farrow. Harriet Els produces this program along with Bob Carlson, Connie Alvarez, Holly Tarson, and Candace Moyer. Thanks this week to Whitney Alderson. I'm Evan Kleiman. See you next week for another edition of Good Food.